The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 13, Side 2. Johnson's statement did not, however, end the speculation, and it helped to keep the story of Box 13 alive in Texas. Year after year, references to it continued to appear in the state's newspapers and magazines. A 1976 Texas Monthly article on historical markers you will never see referred to the group of dead men who had risen from the grave to cast their ballots in alphabetical order for Lyndon Johnson. It had become an enduring part of the state's political history, and when Johnson moved onto the national stage, the story followed him. The national spotlight began to turn in Senator Johnson's direction in 1951, when he was named Democratic Whip, Assistant Floor Leader, and as it turned, its glare fell on these vivid episodes down in the valley. National news magazines reported, as did the New York Times Magazine, exactly 87 votes in Texas put Johnson in the position to do his present job. The country was told how, in what Collier's called a fabulous political and legal melee, these votes had been cast. It was told how, in the words of the Saturday Evening Post, Johnson's attorneys rushed into court and obtained an injunction to prevent eliminating any votes on the ground of fraud, how he had won at the convention only through a 29-28 vote, how Justice Black's ruling made it too late to do anything else to keep Johnson's name off the ballot. The national spotlight, in fact, focused on that previously all but unknown kingdom from which those 87 votes had come, and on its ruler. Second Collier's article that same year, an article on George Parr titled Something is Rotten in the State of Texas, said, His power reaches into Washington, and began with a description of the 1948 election. The outcome astounded the state and stunned Stevenson's supporters, because for 6 days after the election, the ex-governor had been adjudged the winner. Then a single precinct had tardily corrected its count by adding 203 votes in its official return. All but one for Johnson. Not a few of these articles, moreover, mentioned a nickname by which Johnson was sometimes known in Washington, Landslide Lyndon. His introduction to the nation came complete with the nickname and with its provenance. As he made his entrance onto the great stage of history, still in a relatively minor role, he entered with that story attached to him. All during the 1950s, as Lyndon Johnson rose to power in the Senate and came to dominate it, his nickname and the reasons behind it punctuated major articles about him. When in 1959 he began running for president, the spotlight intensified and details emerged. Look magazine, in a long two-part biographical article that listed the hurdles likely to arise before Johnson in a campaign for the presidency, included an allegation of fraud in his first election to the Senate. Its author, Bill Davidson, interviewed Stevenson attorneys who had investigated in the Valley and read some of the court transcripts. The article concluded, There is no evidence that Johnson had anything to do with the admittedly peculiar goings-on in Jim Wells County. Johnson did, however, sign a petition for a court injunction that stopped eliminating any of Johnson's votes. Since that time, his enemies have labeled him the senator from the 13th precinct. Even favorable articles, such as a generally laudatory cover story in Time magazine, mentioned the suspicious 87 votes and the notorious Box 13. The presidency brought a spotlight more intense yet, and with that new intensity, the 1948 election was elevated from being part of a cover story on Lyndon Johnson to a cover story itself. At the height of his popularity in 1964, when he won the great election victory, on newsstands all over the country was the story of 87 votes that made history, the cover story of U.S. News and World Report. The 87 votes set him on the road to the White House. If they had gone the other way, Lyndon Johnson probably would not now be occupying the White House. There again were the pictures of the pile of ballot boxes, of Parr, of Hugo Black, of Lyndon and Coke, of Lady Bird with a sad smile. There again was the map of Texas, with Jim Wells County outlined in red. Distrust of Johnson grew during his presidency until, as Richard Revere was to write in the New Yorker, it seems to be a fact beyond dispute that no other president has ever had to live in an atmosphere so heavy with distrust and disbelief as Lyndon Johnson. What may well be a majority of the American people are persuaded that the president is a dishonest and dishonorable man. And as more and more articles appeared attempting to analyze his character and his reputation, many of them turned to the 1948 election for clues. In a way, the most perceptive of these analysts said the oft-repeated stories about that election formed in themselves a foundation for the misgivings. Tom Wicker, concluding in 1983 that after Lyndon Johnson, trust in the president was tarnished forever, added, "Even had there been no war, it would not have been hard to distrust Lyndon Johnson. Hadn't he been elected to the Senate by only 87 votes, widely believed to have been stolen in Texas's notorious Duval County?" As a president passes into history, the perception of his character can sometimes be summarized by a single anecdote. George Washington, with his reputation for honesty and integrity, is often simplistically linked with the probably apocryphal incident of the cherry tree and I cannot tell a lie. Lyndon Johnson passing into history was also linked in the public consciousness with a single incident, not apocryphal, an incident summed up in a precinct number, Box 13. Even after Lyndon Johnson's presidency, even after his death, bursts of news about Box 13 would still from time to time make headlines across the United States. The most dramatic were occasioned by Indio Salas. For 29 years after the election, Box 13's election judge, the man in the opinion of Coke Stevenson's partisans, most directly responsible for the 87 votes that made history, steadfastly refused to discuss those votes publicly or privately. But in a 1977 interview with reporter James W. Mangan of the Associated Press, Salas said that Stevenson's supporters had been correct all along. During his testimony in the Alice courtroom 29 years before, Salas admitted he had lied. Now he said he wanted to tell the truth. Johnson did not win that election. He said it was stolen for him. And he said he, Louis Salas, had participated in the stealing. 3 days after the election, he said he was summoned to George Parr's office in San Diego, where he found the Duke, Ed Lloyd, Alice City Commissioner Bruce Ainsworth, and Lyndon Johnson. Johnson, according to Salas, told Parr, "If I can get 200 more votes, I've got it won." Speaking to Salas in Spanish, Parr asked him to add the 200 votes. Salas refused, he says, but agreed to certify the votes as accurate if someone else added them. "I told him I would certify them because I didn't want anybody to think I'm not backing up my party. I said I would be with the party to the end," he says. That night, at about 9 o'clock, in an office on the second floor of the Adams Building in Alice, two other men whom he refused to identify because they were just following orders, added the votes as he sat watching. "I was right there when they added the names," he told the Associated Press reporter. "They all came from the poll tax sheet. I certified, I kept my word to be loyal to my party." He did so, he said, despite misgivings about the identical handwriting. Asked by the reporter why the handwriting had not been varied, he replied, "How? Only two guys? How are they going to change it? The lawyer spotted it right away, they sure did." Noticing, moreover, that the two men were adding the names from the poll tax sheet in alphabetical order, he warned Parr that it was a mistake not to mix up the names. But Parr was too arrogant to accept advice. "I told George Parr, and he wouldn't listen to me. I said, 'Look at the A. You had 10 or 12 names on that letter. Why don't you change it to the other, C or D or X, mix them up?' But George said, 'That's all right.' George was stubborn. He would not listen to anybody, but it was stupid." Salas confirmed all the suspicions of Coke Stevenson and his supporters. The 200 votes were only some of the votes he had stolen for Lyndon Johnson, he said. On the witness stand, he had sworn that the election was level, nothing wrong with the election. Now he told the Associated Press reporter that the election had not, in fact, been level, even before the 200 votes were added. On election day itself, he said, he had, in the Nayer School, called out, as votes for Johnson, votes that had, in fact, been cast for Stevenson. The Associated Press story was picked up by the nation's leading news magazines and by newspapers all across the United States. Once again, after almost 3 decades, the dateline Alice, Tex was on the front page of the New York Times. Once again, in 1,000 headlines, the familiar words were linked anew with Lyndon Johnson's name. LBJ election stolen, ex-official says. There were again the same references to the notorious Precinct 13, to the notorious 87 votes. The same reminders that, as Newsweek put it under the headline, "History, LBJ accused," suspicions have persisted that Lyndon Baines Johnson stole his way into the U.S. Senate. By 1977, of course, the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library was in full stride as the guardian of Lyndon Johnson's reputation. It swung into action. Director Harry Middleton assured a Johnson biographer, Merle Miller, that Salas's assertions were untrue. "I know Johnson didn't do what Salas said because that would have been dumb," Middleton said. That was enough to convince Miller. In his biography, Lyndon, Miller was to write that Middleton's remark was perhaps the best comment on the Salas story. Using the public relations expertise of 2 one-time Johnson aides, Liz Carpenter and George Christian, the library announced that it would open 5,000 pages of documents relating to the 1948 campaign. That was a lot of documents to be absorbed quickly, particularly by reporters unfamiliar with the rather complicated historical situation, so they could be excused for focusing on a memo from Johnson, actually a draft of a 1948 press release, denying the charges. "I am without knowledge concerning the ballots in either Duval, Jim Wells, or Zapata counties." As if this press release had greater significance than any of 100 others issued by both sides during the investigation. Johnson's supporters focused on Salas's statement that Johnson had been present personally at the meeting in Parr's office. Walter Jenkins, Mary Rather, and Charles Herring held a joint press conference to assure the reporters who had descended on Austin that his presence in San Diego would have been impossible. They insisted that Johnson had remained at his Dillman Street home in Austin for the 4 days after the election, keeping tabulations on the vote counting. "I was there all the time," Miss Rather said. "Congressman Johnson hardly left the house except once to go downtown." Jenkins said, "It would have been absolutely impossible for Mr. Johnson to have been outside Austin for the length of time it would have taken for him to go to Alice." Sick. Their statements were hardly conclusive. All three acknowledged that their recollections of the hectic days 29 years earlier were based solely on their memories, unsupported by any diaries or other documentation, and it would have taken no more than a few hours for Johnson to make the short drive to the Austin airport and fly the 200 miles to San Diego in a Brown and Root plane and then return. But no confirmation of Salas's statement on this point existed. Many of the follow-up newspaper articles treated his statement with skepticism. The story faded inconclusively away. The focus on that single point, however, enabled Johnson's defenders to obscure the fact that it was the only unconfirmed point in Salas's statement. Reporters' skepticism about his other statements would perhaps have been reduced had they been more familiar with the overall record of the case, particularly the transcripts of the testimony given by other witnesses during the federal district court hearing in Fort Worth and the federal master in chancery hearings in Alice and San Diego. The reporters believed that in his 1977 statement Salas was making new revelations. Actually, Precinct 13's election judge was only confirming testimony that had been given by others during those hearings. The principal doubt surrounding that testimony had been the doubt he had cast by denying what these witnesses had said. Now, Salas was admitting that his denials had been false. Another decade later, in March 1986, I located Luis Salas in Houston. He was living with his wife, Tana, in a comfortably furnished mobile home in the large, pleasant backyard of the house of his daughter, Grace, and her family. The man who opened the door of the trailer bore, at 84, little resemblance to Parr's fearsome Indio. He was no longer tall and broad, but stooped and slender, with gray hair, glasses, and a gentle manner. Throughout the interview, he kept glancing anxiously toward his wife, who was sitting in the next room, obviously in poor health. But his eyes were keen, and he was mentally alert. I was asking questions about the 1948 election when Salas suddenly said, "I have written it all down." Walking over to a trunk, he bent down stiffly and pulled out a manuscript, 85 pages of it typed, obviously by someone unsure of the rules of punctuation, with 9 additional handwritten pages attached, and handed it to me. A paragraph near the beginning says, "Reader, I don't know if my story is to your liking. Writing nonfiction is hard. I had no schooling. Please excuse my spelling and grammar, but I had to write this book to leave it to my family when I go beyond. My time is running short, and I want to finish without adding or subtracting parts that are false or invented by my imagination. No, everything has to be exactly the way it happened." The title of the manuscript is Box 13. The manuscript is actually an autobiography written in 1979. It tells in detail the story of Salas's youth in the little Mexican town of Bermejillo, while Pancho Villa's Mexican Revolution was raging. How he learned Morse code at 14 and became a railroad telegraph operator, how my Indian blood made him a fighter, and his size and temper made him feared until my character was hard-boiled, cynic, and arrogant, and never looked for trouble, but if trouble came to me, I was right there. When he was 23, he wrote, he shot a man who later died of gangrene from the wounds. The man's relatives swore revenge, and he fled Durango. I was to become the wandering Jew, he wrote. For years working as a telegraph operator, he lived in lonely little shacks along the lines of the Mexican National Railways until, in 1936, he crossed the border into the United States and settled in Alice. I missed the mountains. Here was endless flatland. In 1940, he related, he met George Parr, whom he revered and who gave him money and a car and badges and made him his enforcer. My life changed with the power invested on me. Wearing a gun gave me a sense of security, but very few times I used the gun. Most of the disagreements I had were resolved with my fists. I weighed 210 pounds. As long as I live, I never forget this man, and when I gave him my word to stay by his side regardless, I meant it. So up to date, I still worship his memory. In his manuscript, Salas attempts to explain his motives for writing it. One, he says, was to show people the corruption of politics. This explanation becomes less convincing as Salas talks, because of the pleasure in his voice and on his face when he says, "Any vote for Stevenson," smile, "I counted for Johnson." But in the manuscript, he also gives other motives which ring more true. In part, he stated, he wrote his book because he wanted his children to know the story of Box 13, and indeed of his whole life. "Now is the year 1979, he wrote. "I am running short of time, feel sick and tired, but before I go beyond this world, I had to tell the truth. My wife Tana know why," he certified the 200 votes, "for Lyndon Johnson, but my three children, they don't know why. When they read my book, I hope they will understand and find me free from blame. I am certain they are not going to be against me." Before he died, he wrote, he wanted to put down the truth for them. And in part, he stated, he wrote his book because he wanted history to know the story of Box 13 and his role in it. The elderly, frail Mexican-American man sitting in the trailer in Houston felt very strongly that he was a part of history, a small but, in his view, a vital part. I had to certify the crucial 200 votes. We put L.B. Johnson as senator for Texas, and this position opened the road to reach the presidency. And he had written it exactly the way it happened, so that history would acknowledge his role. His story, he wrote, is the story of how an Indian boy raised in the rugged mountains of Durango came to this country and was involved in one of the most notorious scandals of politics that opened the road for L.B. Johnson to reach the presidency of this country. This is history, like it or not. Nobody can erase these facts. Salas's pride, moreover, was clearly hurt, but when finally, in 1977, he told the Associated Press the story he had waited so long to tell, many people did not believe. "The people have a good reason not believe what I wrote in the book," he admits in Box 13. "The reason is that I lied under oath." But he said the story he told the Associated Press was the true story. As for the Johnson Library, quoting at one point from the transcript, which he refers to as the questionnaire of the master's hearing, he stops and says, "Reader, it is a long questionnaire. If you're willing to read it all, go to the Lyndon Johnson Library in Austin. Of course, you don't find there that we stole the election for L.B. Johnson." Perhaps, he wrote, if he put all the facts down in detail in a book, people would believe. During the years since he had written the manuscript, he had several times made additions to it. In some of them, he expresses confidence that eventually he will be believed. "Maybe I pass away before I see my book published," he wrote, "but someday it will come out because it is part of history of the United States, and people have the right to know the exact truth." At other times, as he grew older, he was more pessimistic. At one point, he wrote in hand, "I have been having trouble to publish. Some publishers don't believe what I wrote is the truth." Later still, he wrote, "One thing worries me, and it is that I won't be here to see my book published. My time is getting shorter and shorter every day that goes by." In Box 13, Salas mentions two other reasons for coming forward at last to tell the story he had concealed for so many years. One is that George Parr died. "I gave George my word to stay at his side to the end," he wrote. "That end came when George died. That released me from my promise." The other reason he gives is yet one more reminder of the force of the personality of the former governor of Texas, and of its effect on people who hardly knew him. Salas wrote about the moment in the hearing in Alice when the Federal Master announced that Justice Black had ruled and that the hearing was over. As the announcement was made, he wrote, "I look at Coke Stevenson, and that gave the shivers. Still remember the look in his eyes, frustration, despair, and desperation, when we all heard. At that moment I had pity and compassion for the man. We stole his well-deserved candidacy, and I thought for myself that I brought disaster to another man not involved in no way with my projects. When I was going out, all my friends shouted, 'Viva Luis Salas!' In other circumstances, maybe that could be welcomed. This time I did not feel anything but remorse, knew very deep on me that I had wronged another human being." During the intervening years, Indio Salas wrote, he had been unable to forget the look in the eyes of that strong, silent man, and ever since, "the only remorse I feel is for what we did to Coke Stevenson." Indeed, Luis Salas relates in Box 13, Sam Smithwick was not the only deputy sheriff from Alice who wrote Coke Stevenson the letter. He, Luis Salas, had written him also, Salas says. "I wrote him a letter asking forgivings, but he never answered." "I don't blame him," Luis Salas said. Whatever Salas's motives for writing Box 13, that manuscript and his interview with me adds details to the story of the 1948 election. The manuscript names the men who, he says, actually added the 200 votes, Deputy Sheriffs Willie Mancha and Ignacio Nachito Escobar, and explains why Salas refused George Parr's request that he add the votes himself. "I did not want them in my handwriting. Certifying the votes involved merely giving another total, so he agreed to do that. That night in the dark corridors of the Adams Building, a President of the United States was made." Parr called off names from the poll list, Salas wrote, asking him if the person had voted, and if Salas said the person had not voted, Mancha would add that name to the poll list while Escobar added a Johnson vote to the tally sheet. The manuscript explains the added votes for Stevenson. After they reached the requested 200 figure, Nachito was a jolly man full of jokes. He said, "Let us give this poor man, Stevenson, a pilon, gift," and he added two votes, making a total of 202. As to whether he, Luis Salas, had on election night reported the Johnson total as 765, Salas wrote that of course he had. "I told Cliff Dubose, Dinky Price was there, and he heard me. Price was right, so there you are. If the investigation had continued, they could easily had me indicted." I asked Salas if I could copy the manuscript, and when Salas agreed, we went to a nearby stationery store and copied it on a Xerox machine. "Everyone is dead except me, Robert," he said, "and I'm not going to live long. But Box 13 is history. No one can erase that." On the point in his 1977 statement to the Associated Press, on which attention had focused, whether or not Lyndon Johnson himself had come to George Parr's office to ask for 200 more votes, Salas said that he had recognized Johnson because during Johnson's campaign trip to Alice, Salas had been ill in bed, and Johnson's campaign workers had brought him to Salas's house to meet this man who was so important to his hopes in the valley. On this point, Salas could be lying, or he could be mistaken. Given his very imperfect English, that is a strong possibility. He may simply have misunderstood the introduction of the man who came to his home. Or on that campaign trip to the Valley, a Johnson aide who physically resembled the candidate could have done in Salas's home what Joe Mashman did from the helicopter, pretend he was Johnson to someone who could not tell the difference. Or Salas could be telling the truth. Johnson might have come to San Diego himself to ask for votes. But the point is not nearly so significant as Johnson's partisans made it appear. Although there is still a dispute over whether Johnson asked in person for the final decisive 200 votes to be added to his total, there can no longer, thanks to the confirmation in Salas's manuscript and interviews of the sworn testimony of others, be any reasonable doubt that 200 votes were added to that total, 6 days after the election. Dubose had testified that Salas had originally given the total as 765. Price had testified that it had been 765. The only doubt about that fact had been cast by Salas's denial when he had testified. And now Salas was admitting that he had lied. "I told Cliff Dubose 765. The 200 votes that changed history are, in fact, once one retreats from the headlines, significant only because of their decisive timing. There is, thanks to Salas, no longer any doubt that in his Box 13 alone, far more than 200 votes were stolen for Lyndon Johnson. Jimmy Holmgreen had previously said so. I saw dozens of votes that were for Stevenson counted for Johnson. Ike Poole had previously said so, and now Salas was saying so. If they were not for Johnson, I make them for Johnson. Even Box 13 as a whole, notorious as it became in American political legend, is hardly unique. In that precinct, votes were counted for Johnson, although they had actually been cast for Stevenson, and further votes were counted for Johnson, although nobody had cast them at all. But there were hundreds of Box 13s in the valley. Duval County gave Johnson 4,622 votes, and even the rudimentary investigation cut short by Justice Black's order showed that a high percentage of those votes had never actually been cast at all. The testimony in Zapata County had been presenting the same picture. In the three counties investigated by federal masters in Chancery, therefore, the evidence was overwhelming that a high percentage of the 7,279 votes counted in Lyndon Johnson's totals were not cast at all or were cast for Stevenson. Similar conditions had prevailed in Starr County, which had given Johnson 3,038 votes. And what of the rest of George Parr's domain, his key boxes in Corpus Christi that produced 3,000 Johnson votes, for example? What of Judge Raymond's Laredo? No investigation was conducted there, but no Johnson advisor in a position to know suggests seriously that the 5,544 votes Johnson received in Webb County were level. As for San Antonio where Lyndon Johnson rode the polls on primary day himself to oversee the vast West Side, Johnson's deputies on the West Side themselves boast of the votes that were switched for him there, and the estimate most frequently given is 10,000. Not 87 votes changed history, and not 200, but thousands. Many thousands, in fact. Did Johnson ask in person, or just over the telephone, or just through men like Wirtz and Looney and Clark, for these votes? Johnson's followers deny Louis Salas's contention that in the case of Box 13, Johnson asked in person. But that denial would be significant only if it proved not merely that those particular votes were not stolen at Johnson's personal request, but that he had no personal knowledge of what was going on in the valley as a whole and in San Antonio. And nobody is seriously suggesting that. In 1983, the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library obtained another item that might have been of interest in analyzing the 1948 senatorial election. It was an oral history interview given in that year by William R. Smith, the federal master in Chancery, who had presided over the Precinct 13 hearing. Smith's oral history leaves little doubt as to what his report to Judge Davidson would have said, had not Justice Black's ruling forced him to terminate his hearing. More important, it makes a point that articles on the election almost invariably overlook, possibly because it was so completely blurred by Johnson's oratory. Salas's confession in 1977 that he had lied on the witness stand had come as no surprise to him, Smith told the oral history interviewer. I thought at the time he was lying. When the precinct election judge had testified that he had gone to the Alice News office on the night of the primary and had not given the precinct's election returns to the reporter, I didn't believe a word of that because that's what he went there for. I figured what the hell was Salas doing there if he wasn't there to give them the election returns. But the lie that he, the master, had found most significant was Salas's statement that he had lost the poll list and other records of the election. I didn't believe a word of it, Smith told the interviewer. He kept telling how these poll lists had been stolen and misplaced, and I didn't believe that. That lie, to Smith, was pivotal, because the failure to produce the records was, to his mind, the crucial point in the case. There's one thing that kept going through my mind during that whole hearing, which I thought was probably the most potent fact in the case. At the hearing before Judge Davidson, the hearing before that old Judge Archer in Austin, and the hearing before the State Democratic Committee, if Stevenson were wrong about the illegally added votes, all the Johnson forces had to do was to bring the election poll list and the election return tally sheet of Precinct 13 and show it to them, that there hadn't been anything added, but they never did it. They never did do it. And if they had wanted to defeat Stevenson in the hearing before me, all they'd have to do is bring the official poll records of Precinct 13 of that day's voting and put them before me as proof. Of course, they may have done it later, but I didn't think they were going to. They hadn't ever produced it anywhere else. And to me, that was the most potent fact in the whole case, the fact that they had not brought these things in. That would have been a perfect way to refute the allegation of Stevenson. But they never did do it. He had opened the ballot boxes in the hope of finding the Precinct 13 poll list, Smith said. But I didn't expect to find it. If I had found it, I probably would have fainted. I didn't think it was going to be in there. And, of course, it wasn't. And what would his report to Judge Davidson have said? Smith was asked. What are your conclusions? I was very much of the opinion that the Stevenson people were right. I firmly believe and have for years that the election was stolen in Precinct 13. I'm now convinced that the votes were added, 202 of them, after the polls closed. I think Lyndon was put in the United States Senate with a stolen election, and I think he and everybody else knew it. This statement by the Federal Master in Chancery is the most definitive word available on Precinct 13, since his report would have been the basis for Judge Davidson's ruling on whether or not to keep Lyndon Johnson's name off the ballot. But it is a statement that, so far as can be determined, has never appeared in print. In the landscape of Lyndon Johnson's life, already littered with stolen elections, the 1948 election was simply one more detail. Its larger significance lay in the increased clarity it gave to certain aspects of his character. Prior to his entrance into campus politics at San Marcos, no one, as another student recalled, cared about campus politics. Elections for class offices or the student council were casual affairs. But Johnson saw in those elections an opportunity to obtain a measure of control, small but pivotal, over the fate of some of his fellow students. At this poor boys' school, a diploma was for many students the only hope of escape from a life of poverty and brutal physical toil on their families' impoverished ranches and farms. And in the Depression, campus jobs, with their tiny cash stipends, represented the only means by which these young men could stay in school and obtain their diplomas. Johnson saw a method by which the victors in campus politics could obtain authority to dispense those jobs. And to obtain this power that no one else had focused on, he did what no one else on the sleepy campus had done, created out of a small social club a disciplined and secret political organization. And when, because of his personal unpopularity, the club could not, despite his organizing, win elections, he taught unsophisticated farm boys how to steal elections, and how to win them by other methods. Blackmailing a popular rival woman candidate out of a race over a meaningless indiscretion, for example. Things we would never have dreamt of if it hadn't been for Lyndon. College Hill's pattern was repeated on Capitol Hill in 1933 and 1934. The Little Congress of Congressional Aides was a social organization, but Johnson saw in its presidency a means of entree to men of power. Again, there were repeated complaints, this time from fellow Little Congress members, that he had stolen elections. Everyone said it. In that last election, that damn Lyndon Johnson stole some votes again. When, in 1933 and 1934, Johnson was accused of stuffing a ballot box, he was not yet represented by Abe Fortas, and his accusers succeeded in accomplishing what Fortas prevented Johnson's 1948 accusers from accomplishing, opening the suspected ballot box. When the little Congress box was opened, it was found that the accusations against Johnson were true. Again, as at college, what he had done was unprecedented. No one had ever stuffed a little Congress ballot box before, and perhaps no one would ever stuff one again, for after his departure, the organization quickly reverted to its easygoing social role. My God, who would cheat to win the presidency of something like the little Congress? In his first campaign for the Senate, he stole thousands of votes, and when they proved insufficient, he, O'Daniel, stole more votes than we did, that's all. His reaction was to try to steal still more, and his failure in this attempt was due only to his irredeemable tactical error, not to any change in the pattern. In making the attempt, he tried unsuccessfully to persuade George Parr to go further than even the Duke of Duval had ever gone before. Lyndon, I've been to the federal penitentiary, and I'm not going back for you. At each previous stage of his career, then, Lyndon Johnson's election tactics had made clear not only a hunger for power, but a willingness to take, within the context of American politics, of course, the coups or assassinations that characterize other countries' politics were not and never would be included in his calculations, whatever political steps were necessary to satisfy that hunger. Over and over again, he had stretched the rules of the game to their breaking point, and then had broken them, pushing deeper into the ethical and legal no-man's land beyond them than others were willing to go. Now, in 1948, in his dealings with the Valley, he was operating beyond the loosest boundaries of prevailing custom and political morality. What had been demonstrated before was now underlined in the strongest terms. In the context of the politics that was his life, Lyndon Johnson would do whatever was necessary to win. Even in terms of a most elastic political morality, the political morality of 1940s Texas, his methods were amoral. At first, as long as an investigation of the result of the 1948 election was still a possibility, Johnson's reaction to what had happened was defensiveness. No sooner had he been safely seated in the Senate, however, than the defensiveness faded and was replaced by boasting. As was customary with Johnson, the reaction was embodied in homey anecdotes and jokes, particularly in one joke, source unknown, which had begun circulating in Texas almost as soon as the election was over. Lyndon Johnson brought it to Washington and popularized it, telling it at Georgetown parties, in the Senate cloakroom, on the Senate floor, repeating it even to reporters who printed it. The story was related with evident enjoyment and with the flair of a master storyteller, complete with accent. The accent was that of a small Mexican-American boy named, variously, Manuel or Jesus. As Lyndon Johnson told the story, Manuel was sitting on a curb in a little town near the Mexican border one day and crying when a friend came up and asked him what the trouble was. "My father was in town last Saturday, and he did not come to see me," Manuel replied. "But, Manuel, your father has been dead for 10 years. Manuel just sobbed louder.
"See, he has been dead for 10 years, but he came to town last Saturday to vote for Lyndon Johnson, and he did not come to see me."
The reaction was also embodied in an imitation carried off with the flair of a great mimic. The imitation, performed at Georgetown dinner tables and in Senate office building hideaways before audiences that included fellow senators and reporters, was of George Parr. Cranking up an invisible old-fashioned two-piece telephone, Johnson would pretend to be Parr calling on election night and shouting over the staticky connection between South Texas and Austin, "Lyndon, this is George. George Parr. Can you hear me, Lyndon? Can you hear me?" Johnson would then act out his own role. "Yes, yes, go ahead, George." Then Johnson would imitate Parr reporting the election results, always ridiculously lopsided in favor of Johnson. "Well, thank you, George," Lyndon Johnson would say with a grin. "That's mighty nice." The imitation was one of Lyndon Johnson's side-splitting acts, Hugh Seide would write. Johnson was funny imitating Parr. The thought of Parr was funny. And, of course, Johnson's reaction was embodied in his nickname. The identity of the coiner of that nickname cannot be definitively established, although it may have been Lyndon Johnson himself. But Johnson was among those who popularized it and made it a familiar part of the slang of insider Washington. From the start, he disarmed suspicious senators he did not know by sticking out a hand and saying, "Howdy, I'm Landslide Lyndon," Alfred Steinberg, a Capitol Hill reporter and Johnson biographer, was to write. During the first weeks after Johnson returned to Washington following the election, fellow senators and friends would pick up the telephone to hear him drawl, "This is Landslide Lyndon calling." Within a very short time, he stopped using the nickname, came to dislike it, and more than once flew into a rage at someone who used it. But it was too late to erase it from Washington's consciousness. The nickname was too vivid, and it had been circulated too widely for it to be forgotten. And, of course, he never completely stopped telling the 1948-related anecdotes and jokes and doing the side-splitting George Parr imitation. Most contested intrastate elections are not items of intense interest in Washington. Who, for example, would remember even a year or two later that another new senator elected in 1948, Robert Kerr of Oklahoma, had also been charged with election irregularities? Loud though Kerr may have been on most subjects, he was discreet on that one. Texas's 1948 campaign had never been followed particularly closely in Washington, except by Johnson intimates. Awareness of that campaign would normally have faded fairly quickly. Instead, awareness grew and became vivid. The campaign became a staple of Washington conversation. The joke, the anecdotes, and the nickname had made it well known, had kept it in Washington's mind. Johnson's repetition of the anecdotes had, moreover, let Washington know that there was at least some truth in Stevenson's charges. Johnson's portrayal of Parr's telephone calls, for example, would hardly have led a listener to believe the charges were untrue. And the man who was repeating the joke and the anecdotes over and over, year after year, was the man accused of stealing the election. If there was anyone in Washington political circles who didn't know that the 1948 campaign was a good story, it was not Lyndon Johnson's fault. And everyone did seem to know. It was at least in part because of him that those first magazine articles in 1951 and 52, which brought him to the nation's attention, focused so strongly on that campaign. As years passed, the campaign became a minor American political legend, a legend with a decided tint of crookedness. And for some years, the memory was kept vivid by the very man who had allegedly done the stealing. People hearing him reminisce about the campaign or watching the grins and winks with which he joked and talked could hardly escape getting the impression that the election had been stolen and that he was not ashamed of that fact. Far from it. The impression he conveyed was of a politician who had outsmarted an opponent, done something illegal, and hadn't been caught. The impression he conveyed was of a man who not only was unashamed of what he had done, but who was proud of it, who boasted about it. Among Washington insiders, of course, Lyndon Johnson had long been known as a political manipulator, a wheeler-dealer. But this image had been unknown to the public at large, because Lyndon Johnson had been unknown to the public at large. So by relating the 1948 campaign in detail, magazines first conveyed to a nationwide public the impression of Johnson as a manipulator, a schemer, a somewhat unprincipled and unscrupulous wheeler-dealer, of a deceiver proud of his deceits. First impressions are strong and hard to dispel. The image would, of course, become very important to Johnson's later career, but even more important was the fact that he had deliberately created and cultivated the image because it was the image he wanted to project. The poignant reason he had wanted this image, the reason it had been terribly important to Lyndon Johnson that he be known as calculating, shrewd, tough, hard, ruthless, practical, and even the most uncomplimentary connotations of that word, was all too easy to understand to anyone familiar with his heredity and with the carefully concealed circumstances of his terrible youth. He had been a Johnson, a member of a family despised because it did not possess, in the term that mattered most in the Hill Country, common sense. In particular, he had been the son of a man whose honesty and idealism had led him into ruin and disgrace and the road-building gang, and had led his son into the road gang, too. Lyndon's little brother, who understood Lyndon so well, said, "It was most important to Lyndon not to be like Daddy." Lyndon Johnson had to prove that he possessed the common sense his father had lacked. He needed respect for his pragmatism, needed it passionately, even if obtaining it meant portraying himself as a wheeler-dealer, a politician in the worst sense of the word. Had the public been aware of the humiliations of the early life of Lyndon Johnson, there might have been at least a measure of understanding of the pain-filled motivations behind the image. But there was no such understanding. There was only the image. Alvin Wirtz had been worried that Coke Stevenson's lawsuit would blackmark Lyndon Johnson. In a sense, Lyndon Johnson had blackmarked himself. When, in the mid-1950s, Johnson began maneuvering for the presidency, he attempted to dispel the impression he himself had done so much to create of the circumstances surrounding the 1948 election. By 1964, running against Barry Goldwater, he was stating that the 1948 election had been honest and that his margin of victory had been the result of Lady Bird's last-minute telephoning. But he was never to be able fully to restrain himself from gloating about his cleverness in defeating Coke Stevenson. In 1967, a Texas journalist and longtime critic who was writing a biography of Johnson, Ronnie Duggar, interviewed the president in his bedroom in the White House. The topic was not the 1948 campaign, but Johnson, rambling about other subjects, suddenly interrupted himself and told Duggar he wanted to show him something. Going into Lady Bird's adjoining bedroom, he rummaged through a closet and after 5 or 10 minutes returned beaming, holding a photograph. The photograph is of 5 smiling men gathered around the front hood of an automobile with a Texas 1948 license plate. Balanced on the hood of the car is a ballot box, marked Precinct 13. The men are Ed Lloyd, the attorney who ran Jim Wells County for George Parr, and who was Johnson's leader there, Parr's cousin, Givens Parr, County Sheriff Hubert Sane, Sane's immense pistol-carrying deputy, Stokes Meisenheimer, and another Johnson ally in Jim Wells, Barney Goldthorne. As Johnson returned with the photograph, Duggar was to write, "He held it forward to me with a kind of pride. The president watched my face as I searched the photograph for its meaning, and as I got it, he grinned at me with a vast inner enjoyment." Duggar asked the president for details about the picture, including when it had been taken, but Johnson said not a word and carried the picture back to its place in his wife's room. This book is concluded on cassette 14.